time for the FTN NBA podcast. Breaking down all the news, stats, trades, and more from the exciting basketball world. Here are your hosts, Adam Pfeiffer and Zach Graham.
What's up, everybody? FTN NBA podcast for Tuesday, January the 17th, 2023. Zach, Adam with you once again for a new week here. First pod of the week. We're going to go over some midseason awards. I know we're not exactly at the All-Star break yet, but it's close. We've had enough games to kind of see where we're at for a lot of these awards. And it's always a fun discussion because there's so many different ways you can go, but especially this season and especially for a handful of these awards. So it'll be fun to see where we are at. Zach, we hopped on stream at 5 p.m. on Sunday. And so say I'm glad I was able to make it because...
Yeah.
It was a stressful day.
You know what else I was thinking, too, is that we were very close to that game being between our two favorite teams, the Bills and the Steelers, if Miami would have lost 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
And the way the Bills played, I don't know that the Steelers don't come out with a win there.
Then I really wouldn't have been able to make it to this
game. I know.
No shot. I thought about that, too. Because Skylar Thompson, the only time he did anything was when the Bills gifted him short fields, which was actually multiple times, which is why the Bills almost lost. Mm-hmm. But the way, Steelers have been playing, Kenny Pickett's been better, who knows? But luckily we have advanced. So, that was a fun day because literally, first of all, the game took forever. As a Bills fan, as a Dolphins fan, as just a casual fan of the NFL, not even rooting interest. Like the game ended, game started at 1 and it ended at 4:54 and we had a stream at 5. So it was just a long day, but this will be a fun episode because we're going to go through a lot of these midseason awards. We have MVP, of course, most improved player, rookie of the year, coach of the year, sixth man of the year. And then we're going to add a couple just fun different awards. I think we're going to add top performance of the season, which this year, I mean, take your choice. You have so many players going for 50 plus points, even 60 plus points, and maybe a couple others. But I do want to hit on some news topics before we start. I mean, you had something you want to talk about from this basketball team, and they're in San Antonio. I don't know if you heard of them. and then there's also we saw it again just before we hopped on the podcast. The last couple of days, we're having more massive performances. Tatum goes for 51 on Monday. We talk about it every episode, and I'll kick it to you for the San Antonio segment. But I remember when I was, younger, and, somebody scored, 28 points. I was like, wow, we had a great game. Mm-hmm. And it's just not a thing anymore. So, what was your kind of takeaway from some of these performances we saw again over the weekend? And then what's going on in San Antonio? Brian Windhorst meme.
Well, I mean, I think when we kind of did, I guess, 3 weeks ago now, when we really first started talking about all these massive performances, individual performances that were happening in the league, I think it was right after the Donovan Mitchell game. And we talked about how other performances that week, and even that same night, I think there was another 50 point game Clay. That night. Yeah. It's just wild right now. Yesterday on Monday, Martin Luther King Day, so obviously you get the all day schedule in the NBA, and in the first game of the day, Jason Tatum just decides to go for a cool 50. Again, no Jaylen Brown, but still scoring over 50 points again is pretty amazing. And I understand that we're in this era of the pace is faster than it's ever been. There's more threes being shot than there's ever been. So the scoring is up, of course. And the league has done things, rules wise to, change the game in that fashion. Right. I think the most surface level one being the shot clock resetting to 14 instead of 24 on offensive rebounds. Just creating more possessions in the game. But I also think just worldwide, and I've said this before too, we have never had this much basketball talent globally in human history. And I think that probably goes for a lot of sports, but it's just awesome to see the amount of talent that is in this league now and the way that they've structured the league where you know, the best players. I think a lot of people would argue that Nikola Jokic and Giannis Antetokounmpo are one and two in some order right now. Both of those guys in smaller markets, at least. And neither guy having to leave, part of it is their personality, but neither guy having to feeling like they need to leave the city to like make their career, right? Like we aren't seeing these absolute all timers force their way. And of course some guys still do, but they're not forcing their way to the New Yorks, the Bostons, the Los Angeles, the Chicago, the Miami. Like these guys don't feel like they need to do that anymore. And it's just great for the league. And like a long winding way to say, yeah, like this is incredible. And it's a great time to be an NBA fan. And I think I'll go back and check from last night, but I feel like last night, like we had the, we had the 50 point game.
LeBron had 48, 8 and 9.
Yeah. Like yesterday
at age 39, 38.
Yesterday was the 16th. So I'm just pulling up the dailies from yesterday. You mentioned
it's gotten to a point too, where it's like all of these young players are doing this too. Like, you know, Luka, Tatum, Giannis, Donovan Mitchell, they're all going for like 50, 60. Mm-hmm. And then LeBron's over here at age 38, age 39, going for 48 points. And mm-hmm. It's just like the fact that LeBron is doing just overall what he's doing at this age is insane. Mm-hmm. And it's gotten to the point to where it's like we just expect it because he's, you know, what, the second? I don't think you can make an argument he's worse than top three of all time. But like even this year, it's even more ridiculously overlooked because everybody else is doing all these amazing things at, you know, 23, 24, 25, whatever years old. And LeBron's over here putting up a lot of consistent 40-plus point games at his age, and it's just, like, not even being discussed. And it's still, like, LeBron's probably going to have, like, LeBron's an MVP candidate just because of the numbers he's posting. But it's, like, in this season, it's, like, oh, he's eighth. He's ninth in MVP. It's just stupid.
Yeah. Well, and 51 from Tatum. You mentioned the 48 and 9 assists and 8 rebounds, too, for good measure for LeBron last night in that win.
And, of course, like ESPN and like NBA tweet out the graphic of a stat line and everybody's commenting, but it's the Rockets. I'm like, I don't care. Like,
yeah,
I don't care.
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. And then those two overshadowing the 41 points that old Steph Curry dropped.
Vucevic had 43 the other day against Golden State. Like,
I mean, look, last night, outside of those three, the Tatum, LeBron, Steph, 41 plus for all three of those guys. You had an additional 9 players go for 30 or more, including a career high 33, 15 and 6 with 4 blocks from Alperen Şengün in that same Houston and Los Angeles game. You had Jrue Holiday without Giannis going for 35, 11 and 4 with 2 steals. Jordan Poole. So Jordan Poole and Steph combined for 73 points. Poole had 32 of his own. I mean, even TJ fucking McConnell getting in on the action, 29, 9, and 5 with 3 steals. Like,
he had 25 in the first half.
And I think there's, like, again, a lot of people, I think, would point to kind of what we talked about a few minutes ago, is like the pace and the way the game is changing compared to even 10 years ago. Kind of when we saw this, you know, revolution start to happen with the end of the Spurs and the beginning of the Warriors dynasty, where those two teams played very similarly. But yesterday, like, 35 players yesterday on the 9-game slate scored 20 or more real points. It's awesome. It's just, and including the 2020 from Walker Kessler, who we might talk about a little bit later. Like, there's just all kinds of names and storylines happening, like, not just yesterday, but every night in the league. And I think we could probably sit here daily, 7 days a week, and have 8 or 9 guys that have performances that are noteworthy and worth talking about and congratulating, I guess, for lack of a better term.
So before we get to these midseason awards, I know you want to talk about a certain center in San Antonio. Yeah. So the floor is yours.
Yeah, I mean, we mentioned Jakob Poeltl a couple times, and certainly we were not the first ones to do so. It only makes sense that San Antonio would be looking to move Jakob Poeltl now. They've actually had, but I think right now, before his upcoming free agency, I believe the largest extension he could have been offered by the club was 4 years for like 58 million, like right 55 to 60 million over 4 years. And Poeltl declined that option, or that extension offer, I should say. And so now that the trade deadline, which is February 9th, so we are about 3 weeks away from that trade deadline, you know, San Antonio is going to run the risk, if they don't move him, of losing him for nothing in the offseason. So I have 100% been, and I know I've said it probably one too many times here on the podcast, that they have to trade Jakob Poeltl at the deadline. It is very encouraging as a Spurs diehard that all the reporting, and including a story this morning on The Athletic from Shams, talking about that the Spurs are not going to take just any old offer, and that there's multiple teams interested. And I would credit you, Adam, because you had this 3 weeks ago. You said, what about the Raptors? And the Raptors were one of the teams mentioned in that article, along with the Boston Celtics, both franchises that have had relationships in terms of trades over the last few years with San Antonio. So it makes sense that really teams in both conferences would have interest there, because you've got these massive centers in both conferences. Obviously, Nikola Jokic, who we'll talk about here in a little bit as well. There are some teams that feel like they need to get reinforcements in their front court to deal with somebody like Jokic, or at least hope to contain him somewhat in a playoff series. And then you look at Joel Embiid on the other side in the East, and certainly some teams trying to load up for that as well. So it'll be interesting to watch Poeltl. Again, had to get the Spurs quota out of the way early. I don't think we're going to touch on the Spurs again, at least this episode. We'll talk about Poeltl, I'm sure, in each episode leading up to the trade deadline. But some other pieces that I found interesting from that article, not all of which were like breaking news, kind of culminations of some whispers that had been going around. John Collins and Jay Crowder are potentially two pieces to start a trade between.
John Collins is on the trade block? No way.
So the idea that those two guys could be the, I don't know if you ever called Jay Crowder the centerpiece of a trade, but like the building blocks for a potential trade to get John Collins to Phoenix and Jay Crowder out of Phoenix, it doesn't make much sense to me from the Atlanta side of things, because they would have to be getting, I think, a significant amount of assets in addition to Jay Crowder to move John Collins. I just don't personally see those two players, especially at this stage of Jay Crowder's career, as like comparable at all. And obviously, like, we could go into salary implications and contract extension possibilities for those guys. But I find it interesting that Atlanta was the team brought up in Jay Crowder discussions, because I personally, and we can talk about some tier updates later on as well, I don't view Atlanta as being anywhere near even that dark horse category right now. So I don't know what their incentive would be. Again, outside of Phoenix offering some more attractive assets, I don't know what their incentive would be to go get Jay Crowder. And then the last one, just again, a credit to you. You were talking about the Hornets. We are certainly not the first people out there to talk about how many assets the Hornets have that could help other teams here at the deadline. But they were also brought up in that article this morning. So just another team to watch here as things really start to heat up with, I don't know, 20 days, give or take, until that February 9th deadline. So yeah, I thought that was interesting this morning, and it got my blood pumping for the trade deadline.
Got you right to the machine.
Yeah, well, again, not yet, but we'll see. Maybe as we go along here, maybe I can cook up, Poeltl to Boston, a Jay Crowder and John Collins trade that maybe makes some more sense to me, at least, than it does on the surface level.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. It's always one of the most exciting times of the year for the NBA trade deadline. Let's get to these awards, though. And yeah. Look, there's going to be a lot to change. Obviously, it's only not even, the All-Star break yet. We're getting close. But do we want to start with MVP or let's just start with MVP. Because yeah, this is probably the most fun to talk about, especially this season, because there are 7-8 players that have legitimate cases. Obviously, mm-hmm. many players more so than, you know, the 7 to 8 range. But I don't think if anybody's listening to this podcast at all is going to be surprised by who we have. And I don't care that it would be his third in a row. I've said this many times.
Yeah.
It should have literally zero to do with your thought process on who should win the MVP. Whether it would be his sixth in a row. Because it's not like Jokic, and by the way, it was Nikola Jokic. It's not like he is doing this in a season where he would win his third in a row, and it's like, okay, he's having a good season again, a great season again, but he just keeps getting better. He's essentially averaging a triple-double. He is all the advanced metrics. He's like the king of advanced metrics, as we know, as we've seen. But they're like a 20-win team when he's off the floor. And they're like a 60-plus win team when he's on the floor. They're plus 16 points per 100 possessions when he's on the floor. It's the highest among all players with at least 500 minutes of floor time this season. It's the highest among anybody. It doesn't matter if you played 1 minute. He's still the highest. Plus 24.9 or 23.9 difference. He's just... We know how amazing he is. He's shooting 67% off twos, and I think I saw a stat he has like 10 dunks all year. So like his efficiency is insane. The defense is still, again, he's not going to be Joel Embiid, Rudy Gobert, Jared Allen. That's just not going to happen ever. But he's not a minus. I wouldn't call him a plus, but I wouldn't call him a minus on the defensive end either. So for me, it's Jokic. Giannis is up there, obviously. Durant, before the injury, is up there still for me. Steph can easily make a run here now that he's healthy. Embiid is averaging, he's leading the entire league in scoring. He's been fantastic. Philadelphia is starting to get hot and climb to a top three seed in the East. Luka obviously has as good a case as any. It's just, for me, best team in the West, best player on the best team in the West, best player in the league. Best player in terms of advanced metrics, averaging a triple-double. And, Jokic's triple-doubles, there's not any point where it looks like he's chasing rebounds, chasing assists. It's just he is the offense, he is the system, and he's quickly becoming one of the greatest offensive players of all time, not just current day. Efficiency-wise.
He's already there, isn't he?
I think so. I think a lot of people would hear that and think, whoa, whoa, whoa. But
right.
There's every argument to be made that he's already one of the greatest offensive players in the history of basketball. So no surprise, Jokic is my MVP. It's not a landslide because Luka's doing what he's doing and Embiid's doing what he's doing and Durant and Giannis. Yeah. But for me, I don't give a shit that it would be his third in a row. Has nothing to do, and it should have nothing to do with your thought process, especially when somebody is doing what he's doing. Averaging, 25, 11, and 10?
Mm-hmm.
That's just stupid.
Yeah, I don't think... I also have Jokic as my MVP right now here mid-season, since we are, we're officially now past the halfway point, right? And we always call, the All-Star break is, the pseudo-halfway point for where we say, we're going into the second half now. Is that ever really, going into the final third of the season after the All-Star break? So... I believe every team now at 41 games or slightly past that mark. So the halfway awards, I think it's would be malpractice to not have Jokic number one on any MVP ballot here for all the reasons you mentioned. And you talking about the defense too, right? The defensive rating for a guy like Nikola Jokic was at a career best last year, at least in terms of him playing full minutes. And it's kind of regressed back to a little bit worse than his career average, but the offensive rating is a career high. And it's just the on-off splits, not just for the Nuggets as a team, but how much better he makes players individually when he's on the court.
Aaron Gordon's having insane year. Insane year.
Yeah. It's absolutely incredible. The 9.8 assists per game are a career high. We always know Jokic for triple doubles, right? But career 6.5 assists per game. He's at 10 this year. 8 last year in an MVP season, 8.3 the year before an MVP season. this guy is improving his game. You mentioned career high 62% from the field. He doesn't dunk the ball. The 10 dunks was actually more than I thought it might be. Career high 37% from three, albeit on less attempts here, 2.4 from three. So he's being a little bit more selective. And I should also mention, I did miss. That's not a career high. Second,
I also completely, like, you brought up the 3-point shooting. Just reminded me that he had a step back game winning 3-pointer the other day. Just yep. add to everything he's done.
and we talk about some big shots or big performances going kind of overlooked. I think that was one. I think I saw one person tweet that video. And then we just kind of moved on. Like, it's insane.
It also happened, like, during the end of the Bills game, I think.
True. Yeah, that's a good point.
Which was, like, pretty bad timing. but, yeah.
Yeah, it's Jokic is incredible. And it's also, like, part of how good he is that he has now broken this stigma that I don't remember if you or our old buddy Joe Metz were kind of on that. Somebody wins two in a row, we can't give him a third. But that has come out of my mouth.
I bet you Joe's against it now.
But that has come out of my mouth before. And like, Jokic has been so good that he is breaking that stigma, not just for me, but I think a lot of people who follow the NBA closely. So yeah, Jokic number one for both of us.
And do you think he still has an uphill battle though for like the actual media that votes? Because like, I think there is like a preconceived notion heading into the season that like, okay, whether he has a ridiculous season again or not, I just don't want to vote for him. And it's not like we talked about it. We both have Jokic number one, but it's not like he's missing high end competition for the award. I mean, I do want to give props to Luka. Obviously, Joel Embiid's been unbelievable. Durant, I think for me before the injury, Durant might have been number two or three for me. He's been that good and that impactful. But, like, I wonder if still he has an uphill battle because, like, Luka hasn't won one and he's posting ridiculous numbers every single game. So I just kind of wonder if that could still be a thing, even despite the fact that he's doing what he's done the entire first half of the season.
I think there's enough right now. Again, right, these are halfway awards, so we're only basing this off the 41 to 44 games that each team has played. I think for all of the reasons that you mentioned, if doofuses like you and I, right, can come up with multiple reasons why this guy should break that mold and get his third straight MVP, I think the people that are like smarter than us, like, probably also know those reasons and have a few more. It certainly does not hurt, like you mentioned, for the Nuggets to have the best record in the West, second best in the league, and it's all clearly on the back of Jokic. So, I think Big Honey's going to do it, and I'll knock on wood right now to, you know, hopefully ward off any unfortunate injuries to him or anybody else on that team. Because if somebody else goes out, and we've seen Jokic keep this team more than afloat by himself before, but if they lose one of those guys, your Aaron Gordons, your Jamal Murray's, and I'll throw Michael Porter Jr. in there, although I do think I'm in the camp of, like, and maybe the minority, where, like, I don't quite see what other people see in Michael Porter Jr., but I think all four of those guys certainly in, like, KCP, Bruce Brown place, that, like, it's really their top 7.5 guys that they're going to need in the playoffs. And if one or multiple of those guys goes down, it'll be interesting to see how that conversation could change. But halfway award, I think Jokic is, like, almost running away with it in my book. My number two was Luka. I mean, there's a very similar argument to be had, I think, for Luka Doncic. Over almost 5.5 points more per game over what he did last year. 6.5 points over his career average, beating his career averages in rebounding, in assists, in steals, in blocks. He is lower than his career average in turnovers. Like, I don't know what else we expect this guy to do, especially with the supporting cast that he has that's not great. and also been injured for a while.
Dude, he has the case that Jokic had last year, and that's why it's really interesting, because
it's a good point.
Jokic, no Jamal Murray, Michael Porter was out, and I forget exactly where they finished in the West. Were they like six or something? Maybe even higher.
I believe, I think six is correct.
Yeah, yeah, and granted, the West is clearly a lot more wide open this year, but like, if Luka gets them top five, maybe even fourth or so in the West, and assuming they do finish that high, he will obviously be posting similar numbers to what he's done this season. He has the same case Jokic had last year when he won, and might even have the stronger case of, you know what, we know he's going to win one or multiple of these awards anyway. Give him this one now. Not that it's not like give him it, like he doesn't deserve it. He's amazing. So I think at this point, I would, especially with Durant's injury, at this point, I'd be really surprised, despite how amazing Joel Embiid and Kevin Durant and Curry and everybody and Giannis have all been, I'd kind of be pretty surprised if Jokic or Luka doesn't win this award. Again, yeah, I think if Dallas completely falls off or whatever, like that can change. But
are they gonna? Because like you would think that that drop off would happen when you're missing huge pieces like Dorian Finney-Smith.
It really just comes down to the rest of the West for me. Like if Golden State gets back on track, if the Clippers can stay healthy, if if who's the other team I'm missing in there? I guess Phoenix. Nobody.
Did you say Phoenix?
Yeah, Phoenix, thank you. If Phoenix can get Chris Paul and Booker back, that's the only thing that can really push Dallas to like a 7-8 type seed. But as long as Luka and Christian Wood are healthy, we've seen he'll be able to do enough for them to be 6-7-8 games over 500. So yeah, like I think he's number two for me as well. And then I still want to put Durant three, but I'm going to go Giannis at three. It's just, I just feel so bad for all these players that are having these ridiculous seasons where it's like, it's amazing, but you're most likely going to be like fourth.
Yeah.
It's like Joel Embiid is leading the NBA in scoring. He's been absolutely unbelievable, and he's probably not even top.
I didn't even consider him.
That's the thing. It's crazy. Like LeBron James is averaging, what, 28-8-7 or whatever at age 38, and he's not even in top seven, and he shouldn't be.
I wouldn't consider him either.
Right.
I'm not trying to diminish. I don't think either of us are trying to diminish those seasons, right? There's just guys that are better. And I'm glad you have Giannis third because I have a different one, so go ahead.
It's really not much. Like Giannis has played most of the season without Middleton, a handful of the games without Drew. He's just, you know, he's actually, like, if you look at his efficiency, he's actually not been quite as good, which just shows how dominant Giannis is. Defensively, he's still been unbelievable. I could argue he should be fourth just because, like, we have seen their half-court offense really, really struggle without Middleton. And a lot of that's because Giannis still doesn't have, like, you know, this, you know, Middleton was the guy that handled the ball for them a lot. So, who do you have third?
So, Giannis was my fourth. Jason Tatum got onto the podium for me. It's not like off the board type of play.
This league is so insane that I overlooked Tatum entirely. Like, he's on my ballot, obviously.
Yeah.
But when I was mentioning, like, the great seasons from players that aren't in the top three or four, didn't even mention the fact that Jason Tatum's the best player on the best team in basketball, averaging, what, 30 a game?
Yeah, 31.1 to be exact. This is a guy who, obviously on his career, only 22 points a game. A lot of that has to do with playing alongside Kyrie Irving and the like his first 2 years. But still, 31.1 per game is more than a 4 point per game increase from last season. He's above his career averages. In fact, a career high in rebounds per game. More than an assist above his career average per game, right on his career averages in terms of stocks and right on his career averages in turnovers. Most shot attempts per game that he's had in his career, shooting at a career high 47% from the field. Career high in three-point attempts, 9.4 per game. That average has fallen off a little bit over the last 2 years as his three-point volume increases, 6.3 per game on average in his career. 8.6 last year, 9.4 this year, both at a 35% clip. So I think that's really the only part. That's the only gripe I have, because obviously we also know that Jason Tatum is an above average at worst and elite at best defender. And so I just think the only improvement I could see for Jason Tatum to make, as he's also above his career average in free throw percentage, 87% on the year. If he got to 38, 39, 40% from three, we're looking at a fairly unstoppable player as well.
He's a 50-40. He's a 50-40 90 candidate for one of these seasons.
Yeah, well, but and that's the thing too, is like it would be an all-time season if he was able to achieve that at these rates, because he's shooting 22 yeah. times a game, almost 10.
I mean, Durant's got to be close to that, right? Has yeah, to
let's
be.
See what KD's numbers are. And again, and Jason Tatum also getting to the line at a pretty high clip, I believe. Pull it back up.
That's yeah, what I was going to ask over you too. 8.5 That's got to be. That's got to be. I've just noticed, like from watching, he's getting to the line way more this season.
Mm-hmm. So you look at KD, a lot less volume here, actually. Under 19 shot attempts per game, under 5 3-point attempts per game, and only 7.3 free throws.
That's what happens when you're shooting 65% off mid-range.
Yeah, and again, which is why Kevin Durant is absolutely in this conversation still, and hopefully he comes back sooner rather than later, although I do think, big picture, with the Nets chasing a title, and like any, like I think Kevin Durant probably gives a shit about individual awards. He wants that ring. You know, he wants that ring away from Golden State. So I imagine he will be out longer than, you know, I guess he's going to be out long enough where his name is going to be removed from this conversation by the likes of us and others, but certainly not trying to diminish what he's done either, because the efficiency, as you mentioned, with those elite numbers is crazy at not a young age himself, Kevin Durant.
Yeah, just. The NBA is unbelievably loaded, and it'll be interesting to see if, you know, I don't think it'll happen, but like I said, I think Jokic or Luka win this award, but doesn't mean, you know, Jason Tatum, Joel Embiid, Giannis don't deserve, because they are unbelievable and having incredible seasons. Mm-hmm. Let's go to Rookie of the Year. This should be easy, but I think you're going to make a case for a couple other players potentially. But Paolo Banchero, I mean, I don't think it's going to be much of a contest the rest of the season. Year one, 21.1 points per game, about 6.5 rebounds, 4 assists. I mean, he's having one of the best rookie seasons in a long time. I mean, he's not going to make the All-Star team, obviously, but like. And again, in a normal season where half the league isn't popping off, like you look at this like six, seven years ago, he's borderline all-star as a rookie, which hasn't happened since Blake Griffin. Like I said, 21 points, over 6 rebounds, almost 4 assists per game. LeBron's rookie season, 21 points, 5.5 rebounds, 6 assists. 29% from three from LeBron. Obviously, that wasn't a huge part of his game or the NBA as much. Paolo not doing much from three either. I think last time I looked, he was at like 31, 32%. But the clear catalyst for this Orlando team, you look at the, like, again, it's not as impressive when everybody's going for 40, 50 every other game seemingly, but to be able to score 20 on almost a week or game-to-game basis as a rookie, still pretty impressive. Paolo's efficiency has been fine. He's the clear winner. I don't think you're going to choose somebody over Paolo, but I do think you want to give some credit to. I'm going to try to guess the two players. One's going to be Walker Kessler. I know that.
Okay.
I'm going to guess Benedict Mathurin is the other.
Okay. Well, Paolo is number one for me. It's pretty hard to actually cast a vote of. A hypothetical vote here.
There's also just like no else. Other really like Benedict Mathurin is, but he's also coming off the bench or has mm-hmm. been since mm-hmm. or was before the Tyrese Haliburton injury. But like, this isn't a season where we see a bunch of these high usage rookies, right? Like, yeah. that's yeah. the other thing. It's a lot of wings. It's a lot of centers. There's really no guards really that have come in and just handled all of the usage for their team.
Yeah, and like, so the only thing that I would take away, you know, you kind of compared the efficiency from the field between Paolo and LeBron's first season. And I think that's pretty much where, like, I'm not holding it against Paolo that he's shooting 44, 32, 76. Like, that's perfectly fine for a 20-year-old rookie, number one pick, who's, and like, shooting those numbers on 16 attempts from the field. Over 4 threes per game, and he's getting to the line at an elite rate. 7.8 free throw attempts per game. You know, you mentioned 6.5 boards, 4 assists, over a steal, half a block per game. Paolo is going to be great. And he's going to be, at worst, just fine, I think. But I did want to make the argument for those two guys. And you got one of them right. Walker Kessler would be third right now on my ballot. We saw an example of what that guy can do yesterday with the 20-point, 21-rebound game. But just like plain and simple, the guy is playing a role in the rotation now for Utah. I expect him to be playing a lot more as the season goes along and that team continues to fall off and try to pull themselves into that tanking conversation, although I do think they started too hot now to catch up to that bottom five or six. Shooting 72% and leading the league in block percentage is Walker Kessler. So
did I make a terrible mistake, by the way?
Yes.
Did I overlook J-Dub?
Yes.
I knew it. As soon as I thought about it, I was like, I'm definitely missing somebody. And of course, we've been talking about him for like a week and a half straight now. And then immediately
adopted him on the pod.
It immediately came to me. I was like, I completely overlooked J-Dub.
Yeah, so Jalen Williams, not to be confused with Jalen Williams. this is Jalen Williams from Santa Clara, right? The one who plays 28 minutes per
game. He does have J-Dub as his name on Basketball Reference, too, so.
Yeah, and that is his Twitter is J-Dub, and his Instagram is Jalen J-Dub Williams, so there you go. And just for those who have missed it on the NBA DFS streams here at FTN, other Jalen Williams is Pig Williams, because he's an Arkansas Razorback. So we got J-Dub, we got Pig Williams. J-Dub is the one who I wanted to talk about here. And again, not making the case to put him over Paolo Banchero, but you look at what J-Dub has done in an offense that includes Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, Josh Giddey, both usage heavy and in Shai's case, shot heavy players. There's plenty of other shot happy guys on this team coming off the bench as well. So shooting 51% from the field is J-Dub. Much to be desired in the three-point category, 29% on 2.7 attempts per game, but 12 points, 4 boards, 3 assists, a steal, and half a block per game, 1.6 turnovers per game. Again, in 28 minutes, he started 27 of OKC, or I should say, started 27 of the 40 appearances that he's made for OKC. And this is what stands out to me, and we'll talk about OKC again when we get to the tiers updates. They may have moved. Now sitting at 21 and 23 on a 3-game win streak. But when J-Dub plays 30 or more minutes for Oklahoma City, they are 10 and 8 this year. That doesn't sound like crazy good, but a winning record in a non-insignificant sample size of 18 games in a season where there has been 44 played by Oklahoma City. They are still 2 games under 500, but in those 18 games, again, 10 and 8 when he plays 30 plus minutes, those 10 wins are by an average of 12.9 points per game, and those 8 losses by an average of 4.9 points per game. So when you play J-Dub starters minutes, the Thunder are a winning basketball team, albeit barely over that 500 mark. So I think that is a big boost to his candidacy. And if anything happens to Paolo, I think that Jalen Williams, J-Dub, is the one who would maybe be able to sneak up there and probably not steal the award, but steal some votes away for sure. He is on the rise. And it'll be interesting to see, too, what Oklahoma City does now. Because, again, we'll talk about them. They are in play for a play-in spot, maybe not even a play-in spot.
Dude.
They are not out of the... it's not out of the question.
The last week and a half, they've crushed Boston. Yeah. They went to Philly and won by like 20.
Mm-hmm.
Granted, they didn't have Durant, but they just beat Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Like...
Adam, I don't know if you have the standings up in front of you. If you don't pull them up. Because I want to ask you, how many games back of the 6th seed are the Oklahoma City Thunder?
No more than 3.
Game and a half.
Okay.
So, like, why not go for it?
And it's not
I'm jumping into the tiers talk.
I know, but real quick, it's not like it's a team where it's like, all right, well, do we really want to sacrifice how high this potential draft pick could be? They have 74 other ones. Like, I understand you want the best odds to get one of the most generational prospects we've ever seen, but their future is bright as hell with or without Victor Wembanyama. Yep. They're getting Chet back. They have a player that's not just a candidate to win multiple awards this season that I'm sure we'll talk about, but Shai Gilgeous-Alexander has gone from an emerging talent to, wow, he's really good, I wouldn't trade him, to he's probably one of the 12 best players in basketball at this point, especially definitely by the end of the season. Josh Giddey is a really good facilitating player that can handle the ball and play that point forward for them. He's going to be a really good player for a long time. You have J-Dub. Like, Chet's going to be back. Plus, you have all these other draft picks.
Exactly.
I like it. We talked about this before, but yeah, J-Dub has been awesome, and he's finally become that fourth player. We talk about this for the Thunder all the time. Who can we trust for minutes from this team other than Giddey, Dort, and SGA? He's become the fourth player where you can finally say, okay, the rotation, he's going to play 30-plus minutes most of the time. And like you mentioned, when he's on the floor, they are not just like this cute team. They are an above 500 basketball club. So, yeah, I'm glad
I didn't think we were going to stay on Rookie of the Year this long.
We talked about him so much lately that I kind of overlooked him somehow. And it's also because, like, he's averaging, like, 11 points per game. So it's like, okay, like, but, like, this isn't a loaded rookie class where guys are scoring 18, 17 points a game. So glad we got to mention him. And then I will add Benedict Mathurin, but I think he's more of a maybe sixth man of the year. Has a rookie ever won that award? We'll talk about that. But that'll be interesting, too. Let's go to Defensive Player of the Year, though, because this is a loaded award. You have Brook Lopez. You always have Giannis. You have my choice, and I'll kick it to you first, but my choice is Jaren Jackson Jr. He's played, I think you mentioned earlier before we got on the pod, like 63-62% of the games. Mm-hmm. But I think it's been a little bit close because Brook has been amazing. I think Brook would actually be number two for me on this award. Mm-hmm. What Jaren Jackson Jr. is doing on the defensive end is absurd. So I'll kick it to you. Is he your choice for this award? Do you have somebody else? I'm probably going to talk about Brook too, though, because Giannis gets so much of the attention, obviously, but that team defensively goes with Brook Lopez at the rim.
Yeah, Triple J is number one for me here. You mentioned, obviously we know he missed the beginning of the season, but started, I believe, all 27 games since he's been back. And playing outstanding, and not just on the defensive end, career high, or not career high, but above his career average, 16.6 points per game. He's shooting 52% from the field. That is a career high, 37% from three, second highest since his second season when he shot almost 40, but 37% from three is still above his career average. A little to be desired still, down 77% from the free throw line after going 82 and 83 in each of the last two seasons. I do expect that number to normalize in the low 80s. Career high rebounding, even with Steven Adams down there gobbling up rebounds at an impressive rate, 7 rebounds per game, right at his career averages with assists and steals, and blowing his blocks number out of the water, which I didn't know was possible because he already led the league in blocks last year at 2.3 per game. 3.3 per game this year. Jaren Jackson Jr.
would lead the league, by the way, if he qualified, which I don't think he qualifies just yet.
Yeah, just yet, but he will. And you look at, again, this guy has been an elite defender since he set foot on the court back in 2018, but his defensive rating of 102 is 4 points better than any year in his career so far. Again, only 27 games so far this year, so some of those numbers will certainly shift, at least slightly, as we continue through the second half of the season, but I don't think it's a conversation, really. I would look at somebody sideways if they had anybody else as number one for Defensive Player of the Year, because the impact Jaren Jackson makes individually and just with the way the Grizzlies defend as a unit is immense, and he is the Defensive Player of the Year. There's going to have to be a seismic shift or change, injury, what have you, for him to not win this award at the end of the year. It may be the one that is sewn up the most at this point.
The Grizzlies have one of the best, arguably the best half-court defense in basketball. Mm-hmm. You look at Triple J, I mean, the fouls are always an issue, but per 36, 4.1 personal fouls per 36, lowest rate of his career. So That's good. We love to see that. Uh-huh. He still takes some terrible fouls. Don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. He knows he's arguably the best shot blocking player in basketball. So he's confident in his ability to contest and block any shot. There's also some fouls, like he'll take some really bad reach-in fouls. I think it was the Golden State game on Christmas where he had three fouls to start the second half, and like 35, 40 seconds into the third quarter, pointless reach-in foul on like Kevon Looney, and he immediately had to sit out the rest of the quarter almost. But still also averaging 4.6 blocks per 36, that's a career high, which is just absurd. And you mentioned the impact he has, right? Opposing players are shooting like 52% from less than 5 feet of the basket against him. That's one of the best rates. They're shooting 34% from 5 to 9 feet when he's the closest defender. Like, and then you look, when he's on the floor, opponents are shooting 11% worse at the rim against Memphis. That is the best rate, or however you want to look at it, the most impactful rate among any player in basketball that's played at least 500 minutes this season.
Yeah, dude, like, that's an insane number.
You just don't score at the rim when he's on the floor unless he fouls you, which yep. he will.
Which
but,
he does.
Right, yeah. But if he doesn't, you're probably not. There's like almost a 1 in 4 chance you're making that shot.
Well, also notable, career best in fouls, only 3 per game.
Yeah.
Has never been less than 3.5 per game. And if you just kind of normalize that out with per 36, it stands out even more.
Can you just imagine if he like... if he just completely cut the fouls out and consistently played 33 minutes. Like, if you told me Jaren Jackson Jr. played 32 minutes every single game for the rest of the season, Memphis's defensive rating is going to be absurd. It's just the minutes when he's off the floor, obviously, they're obviously more vulnerable. But, like, especially when you have Ja, right? Like, we know this team defensively is a lot better when Tyus Jones is on the floor than Ja. But having Triple J behind Ja, just it's... We've talked very highly about Memphis, how they constructed this roster. I'm very mad because when we did that under 25 draft a long time ago, I didn't get him. And I mainly didn't do it just because I didn't want to draft the Grizzlies because I already had John and Bane. But I should have just drafted him because he is one of the... Where would you rank him in terms of most untradeable players in basketball? Because he's got to be top 15 in my opinion. Like, obviously, like LeBron, I understand, but like considering age and everything, the impact he has, the fact that he can not only protect the rim at an elite rate, but he can shoot the three ball. He can guard 1 through 5. As long as he ends up playing enough games to qualify and everything like that, this is his award to win. And I'm excited to see where he ranks among the leaders in the league once he gets enough minutes to qualify or games played to qualify because. Yeah.
Well, it'll be number one.
Yeah, for a lot of things.
Yeah, I just went. I pulled up our draft from the U25. Like, can I? I would like to put Scotty Barnes on the trade block. By the way,
Who else
did you have for defensive player?
Brooke.
Uh huh.
1000% Brooke Lopez.
He was my second.
He's been unbelievable. I also think you have to consider. To an extent, I mean, this we know this award tends to go to power forwards or centers, but OG is amazing. I think he's emerged as one of the 10 best wing/on-ball defenders in basketball.
Uh-huh.
But it's going to be tough for him to win that award. It's just tough for any non-center or power forward to win this award, unless you're Kawhi Leonard.
That's tough. That's a good point. Or Draymond.
Draymond was the other one, obviously.
And he's a utility guy. Like, he plays a lot of center, but he plays some 4. He plays some 1, especially in the half court. My third guy, and I'm surprised you didn't go here. Maybe just a good job by you of not being a homer. I had Jared Allen.
I don't think he's been better than Brooke, though, personally.
No, and that's why he's third for me.
Okay.
Yeah, he was third behind Brooke. I just think he's kind of the same as last year. He's still really good on offense. He's still really good on defense. He was a 106 defensive rating last year. He's 107 this year.
I'll tell you my third in a second, and it's why I didn't have Jared Allen third, obviously, because that's how orders work.
I think that really there's like 3 or 4 guys after Jaren Jackson that I would be fine with people having 2, 3, 4, or 5. But Jared Allen to me just has to be in there because he is the engine that fuels this Cavaliers defense. Obviously, that team is you know, well stocked with some guys who are very apt on the defensive end. But Jared Allen, to me, is the key piece that if you lose him, and we saw that at times last year and for some games this year, the Cavs really struggle. And Evan Mobley does his best. But, like, to me, defensively, I think overall I would rather have Evan Mobley out there if I had to choose between the two. But I just think defensively the Cavs go from the elite tier of defensive teams in the league to probably more like above average when Jarrett Allen sits out. And that's the difference between being in that, you know, dark horse or contender tier and being in the dumb idiot tier, I think. And so, like, Jarrett Allen for me makes the podium for Defensive Player of the Year. But I would look at somebody sideways if they don't have Triple J number one. So I have really no argument unless you bring somebody crazy to the table here.
I don't think this is crazy. And I'm surprised you haven't mentioned him.
Okay.
Arguably the catalyst to one of the hottest teams in basketball.
Okay.
Claxton.
Yeah.
He's been phenomenal. Mm-hmm. Been unbelievable. So I have him third, just ahead of JA. Bam.
Totally fair.
Bam's always in this discussion. I think I probably have JA and Bam both fourth. If you're looking for somebody that's not in the front court, can make an argument for Alex Caruso, not to win the award, but just to kind of give him some flowers. He's obviously always been fantastic, except when he's facing Donovan Mitchell. had to. But yeah,
sorry, I was taking a drink. That's I got it. I just didn't want to like spit take all over my laptop here.
But yeah, Claxton's been one of the best rim protecting centers in basketball. This defense, again, Durant's had a lot to do with it too, but it's been the combination of Durant and Claxton that have really jump started this Brooklyn defense. And obviously, you know, this team goes
as my boy Ben Simmons. He's been good too.
Yeah, but he's missed a lot of time.
Sure, that's fair.
And, like, Claxton's been, he's been the constant. So, he's third for me. Brooke Lopez, it's like, actual, like, tiers. It's, usually, you know, you do tiers and it's, like, a couple players or teams from each tier. For me, it's literally, tier one is Triple J, tier two is Brooke, tier three is Claxton, and then I have tier four is Bam and JA. As one of the, you know, obviously, like, JA, obviously, I love him. But yeah. Bam has been one of my favorite players in basketball for years.
Yes.
I want him to win this award one year. I don't think it's going to be this year because Triple J is doing insane things. But
well, and the Heat aren't as good.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's not necessarily Bam's fault.
I don't know where that team would be without Bam.
Well, maybe in the sucker blue tier.
Yeah, so that's probably my top five right there for Defensive Player of the Year. Let's go to Most Improved. This is another loaded tier, right?
Yes, indeed.
SGA, Lauri Markkanen. Tyrese Halliburton.
Mm-hmm.
It's always an interesting discussion for most improved. It's, is this player that much improved or are they having just way more opportunities? So
exactly.
You're very passionate about this award. I know that.
I am.
So who do you have?
Was that your, I was just going to say, is that your podium that you read off there? Is that your three?
I mean, it's the consensus three, I would imagine. I'm interested to hear your take though.
Okay.
Because you would agree that is the consensus top three without question. But like,
probably right,
that's where the argument comes in, right? Like, Laurie's been, like, these three players, not even hyperbole, have been three of the 15 best players in the league this season, especially Tyrese and SGA. SGA, it's not even a question. But Markkanen has become the focal point of that entire team. Tyrese has the same role, essentially. He's just been the best facilitating player in the league this year outside of maybe James Harden. And then SGA is just, he's just doing what we expect him to do, becoming one of the best players in basketball. So I'll kick it to you.
Yeah. And so I think I'm actually, it's shaping up for SGA for me to be not a one-to-one comparison of Jordan Poole last year, where I thought Jordan Poole was the exact same player he was the year before, just more opportunity. That's not the case here for SGA, but we've seen him play like this, or at least closer to this before than we have for my winner, which is Lauri Markkanen. Again, that's not a hot take. I imagine he is the favorite in Vegas, but like, just again to highlight, 10 more points per game this year compared to last year. He's 8 points over his career average. Career high shot volume, 16 per game. By far his career high, 52% from the field. Career high, 7.1 three-point attempts per game. Another career high, 41.3% from three. 87% from the free throw line is 2 points above his career average. 8.6 rebounds per game is 1.6 over his career average. 2 assists per game, again, career high over his career average. Right in line with his career averages in stocks. He's been incredible and is like not a fringe all-star, is a guaranteed all-star.
Even if the game wasn't in Utah.
100%, dude.
Because like that absolutely plays a role. I think it played a role last year with Cleveland. Yeah. Garland should have been an all-star no matter what. But maybe JA doesn't get in if that game's not in Cleveland. And I think they also had, I forget who it was, but somebody was hurt. Mm-hmm. Because that's how DeJounte and LaMelo got in, right?
It's definitely how DeJounte got in.
But anyway.
I think you're right. Yeah.
But anyway, like, yeah, like if this game is in Chicago, Cleveland, well, it doesn't matter. Laurie's an all-star without even, all three of these players are all-stars.
I mean, the team is essentially, they are one game under 500 right now, but I think outside of probably Pacers and Kings, the third most surprising team, still at the halfway point of the season. Obviously the first month, month and a half of the year, everybody was like, holy shit, Utah, as like we were as well. But the fact that all the stats we just read off about Lauri Markkanen leading this team to a play-in spot right now and very much in the thick of it there. They are a half game back of the six. So again, they are still in the mix. It's just, it's by far Lauri Markkanen to me, because you look at SGA, who is my second pick, and I would have a lot less issue with him getting the sixth man award this year than I would with Poole or Desmond Bane last season. Obviously a career high 30.7 points per game, career high 20.1 field goal attempts per game, 50% from the field, is the second best in his career, because I think that 2 years ago, SGA had a year extremely similar to this, just less free throw, or less field goal attempts, excuse me. And he shot much better from three back then. He was 51, 42, 81 from the field that year. This season, four more shot attempts per game, but 2.1 less three-point attempts per game. So that has been a big reason why, and I'm not breaking any news here. The ability to get to the rim and find the paint is one of the best that we have seen in recent years. I would argue in the last 10 years.
He has surpassed, for a long time for me, like the best at doing that and getting to not only the rim, but then eventually at the free throw line was DeMar DeRozan. He has surpassed. He's the best in the league. He's averaging 24 drives per game.
Yep.
That's three more than second place Luka.
Gets to the line 10.4 times per game. That's an increase of 3.2 free throw attempts year over year. In that year I was comparing, he got to the line 6.5 times per game. So four more free throw attempts per game. And 91% from the free throw line. This guy had never shot above 81 in his first 4 years. So like the improvement for SGA is certainly there, and it's elite. I just don't think his improvement is as stark as Lauri Markkanen's has been.
Especially because Lauri was like, for a while, it was like, is this guy even like a player that should be playing more than like, because like, he obviously was in that three role for Cleveland with that huge lineup, but like, when he was with Chicago, like, there was a lot of concern about like, if this guy was going to live up to anything.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing is, too, like a lot of these games, I would go out, I would venture to say a majority of the Jazz games, Lauri has still started at the three, because they began the year with the Kelly O, Jared Vanderbilt front court. And like the fact that Lauri is doing all of this while playing at least some small forward, obviously when they rotate and they substitute and go through a game, he's not playing the entire game at the three, but like, the fact that he's been doing this with other, you know, multiple other front court players out there with him for a significant amount of time is just even more impressive. And then I'll just mention, I do think Desmond Bane gets the third spot for me. Because of some of the things that we mentioned on previous pods, specifically his not just ball handling responsibilities, but what he's done with them and making his teammates better with a career high 4 assists per game. You covered the Desmond Bane improvements, I think, 2 episodes ago, so I won't rehash that, but he did make the 3rd spot on my most improved ballot.
I've seen some, like, legit kind of arguments for Luka for this award, and I just can't. I can't.
Yeah.
I understand.
I agree.
I understand, but I can't. Is there anybody outside of the 4 we mentioned, Bane, Tyrese Haliburton, Laurie, and Shea, that even has a chance or should even be discussed for this award?
I don't think we need to spend that much time on it. Like, I do think Haliburton being 2nd or 3rd or 4th is fine with me. And, like, the Luka conversation, I don't think is, like, it's not crazy. It just doesn't get there for me. And, like, I would also look, if you're going to look at Luka Doncic, which obviously, like, anybody who listens to this knows how much I love Luka Doncic, you also have to bring Jason Tatum into that conversation, I think, if you're going to talk Luka for this award.
All right, let's go to 6th man of the year. Last year it was Tyler Hero. Mm-hmm. Really was pretty easy, right? It was like his main competition was Kevin Love, Jordan Poole. But like we know, like when Jordan Poole starts, he's an all star. It's just numbers wise, he posts crazy numbers. But anyway, this award, it's always interesting with this award because you have to determine and look how many games these players have started, because like Tyler Hero started a handful of games this season because that team in Miami is perpetually banged up. Christian Wood, you asked me this question a month and a half ago.
Yeah.
Christian Wood's the clear winner.
Yeah.
But now, you know, Maxi Kleber has been out. He started a lot of games. He's banged up now. But like, where are you going with this award? Because I think this is the one award where I'm not even sure who's number one.
So this, I actually think there is a clear number one here. For me, it's Malcolm Brogdon. Has not started a single game.
Yeah, in that helps. Not to mention he's been good, but
yes, and the Celtics are far and away the best team record-wise right now in the league, and I think the best team in the league right now. And only getting stronger as Robert Williams gets back to getting his full allotment of minutes in this rotation. Brogdon's been fantastic. I mean, 49% from the field, 45 from 3, 89 from the free throw line in his 24 minutes per game, 14, 4, and 4. It's Brogdon pretty clearly for me. And then I had more trouble coming up with the rest of my podium here, and I ended up with and we'll talk about these guys here in a second with the tiers, the 4 seed in the West, Malik Monk of the Sacramento Kings is 2nd for me. Interestingly, his minutes have really been jerked around lately in that Sacramento rotation. Coach Mike Brown, I don't know what the deal is there. Now down to 22.5 minutes per game, but still shooting 44%, 33 from 3, and 90 from the free throw line. We know Malik Monk is a guy that can and has won games for this Kings team just with his scoring ability alone off the bench and his ability to create offensive runs. So he edged out Tyus Jones for me, who got the 3rd spot, just because I think in the vein of a Jordan Poole or a Tyler Hero, albeit much less scoring ability there with our guy Tyus, we consistently give this guy his flowers for being what we both agree is the best backup point guard in the league right now.
It's not even a question.
For a while.
Unless you consider Brogdon, but for me, yeah.
But
I've talked about how much I love Tyus. That's been, we talk about the most like overlooked and the best additions teams made in the offseason.
Mm-hmm.
I think Tyus Jones being retained was equally as crucial for a lot of teams that have added players.
Yeah, and I think like, again, just saying, like, in the vein of Jordan Poole or Tyler Hero, Tyus Jones has to start some games sometimes. and fills in admirably. Like, there's no drop off, and we saw that last year. And that's kind of like a franchise thing at this point, and how good the Grizzlies have been with their depth. But because they run such a deep rotation, Tyus Jones to me at least deserves some consideration. Although I wouldn't have an argument with anybody who said, yeah, Tyus Jones like is good, but is more like the fifth or sixth option. I just think I wanted to kind of give him some recognition there.
And, yeah, and
because
like,
I think it's Brogdon running away at this point.
And I think a lot of people listening will be like, Zach, are you crazy? Where the hell is Jordan Poole? Where the hell is Tyler Hero?
He starts.
They've started so many games. Yeah. Jordan Poole started Tyler half Hero, the year.
Tyler Hero is a starter. Like, regardless of the injuries that Miami has on a nightly basis, he was in a starting role coming into the season. And Jordan Poole, again, with Clay not playing back-to-backs and Steph being out for an extended period of time. Jordan Poole hasn't quite started as many games this year, percentage-wise, as he did last year, when, again, it was utterly ridiculous from multiple angles. Both the fact that he started 51 of 76 games last year, and again, was the exact same player, just with more opportunity. This season, started half of the games so far, 22 of the 44 for Golden State. And not playing as well this season as he did last year. So, got me amped up again on Jordan Poole and why he's not the sixth man.
Yeah, I agree with Brogdon. Obviously, if Jordan Poole had started five games, he would be probably the clear runaway. Same with Tyler Hero. May I interest you in Norman Powell as a top three? I would put him one over Brogdon, but right around 16 points per game, despite this team always being injured. He's only started five games.
I'm going to say he's been injured a good bit, too.
Right, yeah, he's played 35 games, so he started five. Shooting 39% from three, averaging 16 points per game. He's shooting like 42% off catch-and-shoot threes. I think he's in the discussion, but yeah, for me, it's Brogdon pretty comfortably. Not just because he's been really good, not just because Boston's been the best team in basketball, but also helps that, you know, Hero and Poole have started a handful of games. And what about Christian Wood, though? Like, he's tough because I want to see how many games he started. Obviously, more so lately since, you know, Maxi Kleber has been out. Like I said, you asked me this a month ago. So 41 games played, 16 starts.
Yeah.
But you look at his overall numbers, like, this is a clear sixth man of the year just based off the numbers. 18 points, 8.5 rebounds per game, shooting 38% from three, 63% off twos.
Yeah,
it's just, is that too many games to have started? I mean, 16 of 41.
I think it's not even just that he started 16 of 41 games, is that he's going to continue being the starter for this team.
Yeah, Kleber's missing a lot of time. So
yeah, and even if Kleber comes back, like, you just can't, like... You can't put Christian Wood on the bench and expect to be the best version of this Mavericks team that you can be. And again, I think that their biggest issue, and I think Dallas fans would be the first ones to agree with us on this, that, like, Luka just simply does not have enough help, especially with DFS and Kleber, and even Josh Green, who was improved this season, out for extended periods of time. And you look at Christian Wood anyways, he's putting up the exact same numbers and opportunity here with the Mavs that he did with Houston in 67 starts last season, 12.9 shot attempts last year, 12.4 this year, 4.9 three-point attempts per game last year, 4.6 this year, 4.9 free throw attempts, 4.3 this year. He's getting the same amount of opportunity. He's a starting player for this Mavericks team, even if Jason Kidd wanted to kid himself at the beginning of the year and think that he should bring Christian Wood off the bench. It just doesn't work. You need that offensive threat out there. And I'm not saying you shouldn't stagger the two guys throughout the game, but you got to start Christian Wood.
Coach of the year. Have a lot of candidates here. You have, obviously, Joe Mazzulla taking over. Best team in basketball. Yep. You have Jock Vaughn, who has helped that massive turnaround for Brooklyn, who have become the best team in basketball, statistically-wise and record-wise, I believe, since he's taken over. You have, I think, Willie Green deserves a lot of consideration, A, because that team's obviously, like, he was great last year, too. Mm-hmm. And I believe he was one of our favorites to win the award prior to the season starting. That team has had so many injuries, and it's not just a couple rotation players. It's been B.I.'s missed a ton of time. McCollum's missed time. Zion is now out with the hamstring injury. You know, Herb Jones and some of these wings, Larry Nance, they missed a lot of games. So he's done a great job to keep them afloat. And then I also think you have to consider Mike Brown. Mike Brown has done an amazing job with Sacramento. Obviously, they are one of the surprise teams of basketball. I don't think he's my choice. My choice is going to be Jacque Vaughn. But I do want to talk about Mike Brown, too. So who's your coach of the year through the midseason point? Is it, you know, coach of the best team in basketball, Joe Mazzulla? Is it Jacque Vaughn? Where are you going?
Yeah, it's boring. It's the coach of the best team in basketball, Joe Mazzulla, especially considering he stepped in right before the season to take this job. And, like, we thought maybe this team is going to crash and burn with kind of all of the chaos that it was thrown into to start the year. But not to be, 33-12 are the Celtics. So Mazzulla gets my vote. And I think there are a lot of candidates, as you mentioned. First time ever that a coach did not make my ballot because, like some of the players we discussed, hasn't coached enough games, and that's Jacque Vaughn. As much as I want to give my guy Jacque the award, I just couldn't put him on there. So my second and third are actually Michael Malone, too, with a 30-13 record, second best record in the league. And I think he's done a little bit more with less compared to the same record in the same conference, Taylor Jenkins with the Grizzlies. He would have been my fourth, because I did give the nod to Willie Green, although they're 4.5 games back of the Grizzlies. You mentioned the three All-Stars and two other very important players that have missed significant time this year, and the fact they're still 8 games above 500, I think, deserves a lot of credit here. And you mentioned my old guy, Mike Brown.
He's top three for me.
And I have no issue with that. I think this is the award where, like, I don't think it's Mazzulla's, like, running away with it. Yeah. In my eyes.
I understand your argument, but I still have Jacque 1, Joe Mazzulla 2, and I'm going Mike Brown 3. Look, I've talked a lot about what he's implemented to this team, where it's worked perfectly, where they have Sabonis running the offense and just everybody moving around it. And it's led to them having, I think, the third highest offensive rating in basketball. They're fourth in, I believe, turnover to pass ratio or assist to turnover ratio. They have just been, like, it's not this cute story anymore. Oh, Sacramento can score a lot of points. They're, like, legitimately an elite offense. So I think Mike Brown has done just an unbelievable job. So I have him third behind Mazzulla and Jacque Vaughn. I mean, Jacque Vaughn, that turnaround is, like, that team was in shambles. There was a lot going on. They were struggling. Their defense is awful. Their defense is still, you know, it's been much improved. And he's been just unbelievable for that team that has been, since he's taken over, arguably the best team in basketball. So, but yeah, if you put Joe Mazzulla first, because, you know, for many reasons, I have no problem with it. But yeah, I think this is going to be one of those awards where can go a lot of ways the rest of the season, right? Willie Green could easily win this award by the end of the season, because he's been so good despite having so many players out for the first half of the season. They can stay remotely healthy the second half. This team could finish first in the West. It's not even like a hot take. And if that's the case, he absolutely needs to be one of the top candidates for the award. You know, I think JB's done a good job in Cleveland, obviously. It's just he's not top five for me. And then really, like, in that same kind of range, just a little bit below, would be Rick Carlisle. But again, just not even close to the candidates we've already mentioned.
Yeah, I didn't even think about Rick. That's a good call there. And again, I think it's just proving true what we said to start this Coach of the Year segment, right? There's just so many ways it could go, and I think neither one of us would have real issues with it. I have a stat and a question for you to close out Coach of the Year. First, the stat. 24% is the number, Adam, and that is the number of NBA head coaches that either played or coached for Greg Popovich. So I think it is blasphemous that the Coach of the Year award is the Red Auerbach Trophy. It absolutely needs to be the Greg Popovich Trophy. And that leads me into my question. There are three active head coaches with multiple Coach of the Year awards. Can you name them?
Three with multiple.
Three active, yes, sir.
Does Budenholzer have two?
Budenholzer has two.
Budenholzer, Pop.
Mm-hmm. Pop is two. He's got three.
And I feel like either the Budenholzer one was a tough one, or this third one's a tough one, or I'm just completely overlooking it.
I would have said Bud would have been the toughest one for me. I'll go ahead and let you know. Tom Thibodeau, two Coach of the Year awards. And I did
so
say...
So I actually wouldn't have guessed Tibbs.
Yeah, so the interesting thing to me about those two guys is both of them did it with separate franchises. So Tibbs, Bulls, and Knicks, Bud with Hawks.
The funny thing is I immediately thought of Atlanta instead of Milwaukee for Bud, because that was the year they had, what, all the All-Stars? And then LeBron just completely destroyed them in the first round.
And I said active because Mike D'Antoni also multiple Coach of the Year awards. Obviously not an active head coach at the moment. Greg Popovich Award. Make it happen, NBA.
He's the best.
He is.
So that's the end of the kind of straight up concrete awards that you'll expect to see, but I tried to think of some fun ones. I don't know if you thought of anything. I kind of brought up before the episode, we like performance of the year can always be interesting when we led with all these amazing performances this season. It's either Luka going for 60, 21, and whatever it was, 12 against New York. Mm-hmm. But I'm going 71 for Donovan Mitchell. Bias aside, I mean, scoring 71 points on the efficiency and having 11 assists, and at no point did it seem like chasing, and the fact that they needed every single bucket to come back and win that game, and the fact that, sure, the game went to overtime, but it doesn't go to overtime unless Donovan Mitchell has that circus free throw play at the end of the game. So I'll lean Mitchell, but I mean, if you want to choose any of Luka's 48 amazing games this season, sure. Jokic is, 50? He had a 50-point triple-double earlier in the year, right?
Yeah. What's great about...
And Bede had that game against Utah early in the year for 57, 7 blocks, 12... I don't know, man. Have fun. Find whoever went for 50 that week.
What's great about Luka is, he's only played, 43 games, yet you're he's had 48 great performances, and you're not wrong. Somehow.
Well, I'm just looking forward to the next five he plays. Yeah. And assuming...
I mean, I think we talked about the Mitchell performance last episode or episode before last. I cannot disagree with you there. Even with your homerism just dripping from your microphone, it's well worth it in this scenario. 71, especially with how he started that game, as we talked about back then. That was super fun to watch.
Any other, fun kind of... not, kind of off the radar non-chalk awards?
So, I was just thinking before we recorded, and I said this to you before we started the episode, I wanted to do worst value award, which was either a trade or a draft pick or a signing.
Oh, Rudy Gobert, okay.
Yeah, so it was just kind of I have to throw in the caveat of non-Rudy Gobert moves. And it's just it kind of crumbled.
I wouldn't even say DeJounte, because the Hawks' problems have not been DeJounte related. It's been everything else, in my opinion.
Yeah. And so I guess the only thing I had left to do was give a tier update. Because I do have some movement on the tier chart.
Got to get a drop for this too. We need a trade machine drop.
Yeah.
And a tier update drop.
I do have a trade machine to do.
Of course you do.
Before we go as well.
Water is wet.
We moved two teams down from the favorites to the contenders tier, those being the Nets with the Kevin Durant injury. Just some uncertainty there, and I think just right now, them and the Denver Nuggets were both the two in-between teams that got knocked up to favorites to start the tiers segment, and this week, both of them down into the contenders tier. I just think Denver, I have a little bit more hesitation on them. As well with the Nets compared to Boston and Milwaukee, who remain in that favorites tier. We lost one of the contenders down to the dark horses tier, that being the Dallas Mavericks. Again, kind of injury related, but I also think that there is some budding frustration, and maybe budding is too loose of a term, because There's just a lot of consternation between the fans and the franchise there in Dallas right now in terms of like.
Did you see the fans? Did you see the mural?
That's what I was getting to, is that there was a mural painted, basically saying like, "Get Lucas some help." And
it had all of his ridiculous stat lines around it, and it said, "Please send help" or something.
Yeah, and Mark Cuban apparently did not take kindly to that, and responded to that artist, and their back and forth was kind of entertaining, but we don't need to dive into that now. The Mavericks are now in down into that Dark Horse's territory. And then there was one other piece of movement here. And Adam and I now have ordered these, actually. Each tier is now ordered by the closest team to the next tier and the closest team to the tier below. So I guess just I have Boston as the favorite, Milwaukee as number two. And then in the contenders tier, the closest to the favorites tier is actually Golden State now that they're healthy, especially seeing those guys in person, albeit against the Spurs, but like watching those guys work. In that Alamo Dome game last week, they're a fucking juggernaut, man. So they are now the top team in that contenders tier. The Sixers are actually the final team of those six in the contenders tier. Mavs, the top dark horse, followed by Clippers and Cavs. Lakers, the last team in the dark horse tier. Not quite dumb idiots yet, although outside of this tier exercise, I absolutely consider the Lakers to be dumb idiots. Raptors, the top dumb idiot team, followed by the Hawks and the Knicks. And then we have our new addition to the dumb idiot tier, and that is the Oklahoma City Thunder, which, like, I don't think that they clearly will not be able to make it into the dark horse tier, because there is no chance that this Oklahoma City team, as currently constructed, could ever win the NBA title. They could trade some of those draft picks and actually probably jump into that contenders tier if they wanted to. But just, Adam, the fact that this team won three games in a row, they are now two games below 500. I mentioned it earlier, they are a game and a half back of the sixth seed. So completely missing the play-in and just getting a playoff spot halfway through a little more than halfway through the season is pretty crazy. And like, again, they could certainly go for it. And we talked about it last time where like we were kind of catching wisps of like, man, if this team like really tried to win, they could probably make the play-in. They could probably make the sixth seed if they actually tried. So like that gets you out of the Sucre Blue tier and into the dumb idiot tier, because they are now 11th in the Tankathon rankings, 11 games back of the worst record in Houston, and again, now 8 games back of San Antonio, who is sitting in that four seed. They have taken themselves out of the Sucre Blue tier, because at this rate, they have zero shot at getting into that top five in terms of ping pong balls. So that was the one, I think, significant move here, was them getting out of the bottom tier on the rankings list. So yeah, there you go.
As someone who still has to this day PTSD from the Golden State Warriors, it just feels like they're going to be in the Western Conference Finals at minimum. Yeah. Still, it just,
I mean, as if they're healthy, it how just, could you pick against
it? Just them? Feels like it. Like, oh, all this crap in the beginning of the season, the injuries, the struggles on the road, which they still struggle on the road.
Shout out to Eddie Fear, who mentioned this the other day. We now have three teams in the West that don't qualify for this, but a week ago, there were zero teams in the Western Conference with a winning record on the road. Zero.
That's insane.
And now you've got Nuggets and Grizzlies both 11 and 10, and the Kings 10 and 9. Still nobody. Yeah, so like
just
nobody.
Just like we projected.
It's crazy right now, the parity out West. And it's how you get Oklahoma City now above the Phoenix Suns record-wise and a game and a half back of the sixth seed. So can we close it out with this trade? It's not super complicated, but I just wanted to bring it up.
Yeah, go for it.
All right, so we talked about the murmurs of a John Collins, Jay Crowder, and pieces trade. So if you're the Hawks here, right, you took a big swing going for DeJounte Murray, trading away three first-round picks and I think a swap for the young All-Star. And it hasn't worked. They're 500. So
I'm interested to see where you go. Atlanta needs a stretch.
So Do you say, and this is one of the hardest things to do, not just in sports as a general manager, but in life.
Well, Atlanta also has new GM now, right?
That's a good question. I actually don't
know. I think Travis Schlenk is not there anymore.
I think you might be right. Let's confirm it before I continue going here. Hawks, GM. That's right. You are correct. Landry Fields. And shout out
Landry Fields. And Korver's there too.
Yeah, so they just named Korver the assistant general manager yesterday. So I imagine that's why you had Travis Schlenk not being there, kind of fresh in your mind. So good on you there, sir. I had forgotten that. But if you're Landry Fields and now Kyle Korver coming in, do you say, Travis fucked up? And we're going to fix that fuck up by sending DeJounte Murray and John Collins to the Suns for Jay Crowder, Chris Paul, and 3 first-round picks.
Chris Paul and Trae Young, dear Lord.
Well, so, like, I mean, and Chris Paul, like, maybe you ship him off somewhere. Maybe you fucking cut him and stretch his contract out. It's just all you're doing there is replenishing the draft picks that you lost and that future. Because I think it's clear. I think, and maybe I'm jumping the gun on this, I think we have enough evidence that DeJounte Murray and Trae Young do not work together. So who gives a shit if you put Chris Paul in there and like you're talking?
It's just weird because like theoretically, I think they should. It's just Trae has not shown any willingness to play off the ball.
Sure.
And it just hasn't worked. Like I said, like I don't think Atlanta's issues are because they traded for DeJounte Murray. I think, well, to be fair, this is obviously leads to it because they had to make this move.
Causes future issues.
But like the move they had to make to be able to trade for DeJounte Murray was the Kevin Huerter trade. And I think that's who they're missing is Kevin Huerter made my underrated team. So I think in the process of that, obviously, yes, the move for DeJounte and Huerter, that move did hurt them. But yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you get those.
I mean, it's silly.
You get the capital back.
But I think like that, if you are the Hawks, what is the more prudent move, especially as new GMs? Like, trying to fix this?
Not to mention, you get those assets back. Trae Young's not exactly someone that it looks like is going to be staying in Atlanta for a while.
Well, and that's the... So, like, there's issues with both point guards because DeJounte Murray is up for an extension / unrestricted free agent in a year and a half.
Yeah, he's on that really friendly contract right now, right?
I imagine he's going to want a little bit more than the 16.5 per year that he's on. And he deserves that. Again, he's not a max player, but he's not a $16.5 million player either. And so like you're going to throw him the contract that you need to get him to stay in Atlanta. And then you're pairing him and Trae Young. So like, I think that in the next year and a half, they have to move on from DeJounte or Trae Young. And they have to determine real quick, I think, which one they want, because the more teams that figure out the spot that Atlanta's in, the less leverage they're going to have to move somebody like Trae Young at, you know, whatever his value peak can be between now and then. Like, I don't know. I just think they are in a really tough spot. And if I'm a new GM coming in there as Landry Fields and Kyle Korver, I want to kick the can down the road and say, the previous guy's fucked up. We're going to get some of these assets back and kind of maybe not totally overhaul the roster, but like we need a reset and we need to pick one of these guards who just clearly don't work together. And so if I can get 3 first round picks back with light or no protections from the Suns and their new owner, who may be wanting to make a splash and change, like you add DeJounte and John Collins to this team, Phoenix is back, baby. Right? Like you get Devin Booker back.
Yeah, it's not even. I was gonna say it's not even just McCall. That. You get Booker back. You add DeJounte and Collins. Mikal Bridges is still there, and Cam Johnson will be back.
Yes, and Cam Johnson can be a sixth man again, which is what he should be.
Right. The only thing that I think can save the Hawks for this season, if they really think one move can get them back on track, like I said, I think they need like a stretch 5.
Sure.
I don't know if there's a trade out there where you trade a team John Collins with that contract and find a stretch 5 that's going to turn their season around. I don't know if that's out there, but
well, and if or can you find a stretch 5 that you can then work in for minutes alongside the other two true 5 men that you have in Clint Capela and Onyeka Okongwu? Well, again, I just think
or stretch 4, whatever.
Sure. But isn't John Collins like already kind of that?
Yeah, but I think he's still good enough. I still think he wants to just, you know, roll to the basket more too, though. And then it's like, okay, you have John Collins rolling to the basket. You have Capella or Onyeka Okongwu at the basket. I don't know.
It also hurts John Collins that he is, he forgot how to shoot. This is a guy who's 36% from three on his career at almost three attempts per game. He was over three attempts per game in each of his last three seasons and shot 40, 40, and 36, 23% from three. This season on the same volume, so like he can be a lot better too. And again, if you have over three attempts per game from a guy like John Collins, like that is your stretch four, shooting 40% over two seasons that he's done before. Like, and that's why some of this value continues to fall off for John Collins, because he's just not shooting well.
I mean, just 2 years ago, his team was in the Eastern Conference Finals.
Mm-hmm.
John Collins was multiple times dunking on Joel Embiid.
Mm-hmm. John Collins was 21.6 points, 10 rebounds, an assist and a half, and over two, almost 2.5 stocks per game back in the 1920 season. Only 41 games, but still, 58% from the field, 40% from three on over 3.5 attempts per game, 80% from the free throw line.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems really, really likely that by even earlier than this time next season, this roster could look completely different.
100%. So, and I think it should, right? Because, like, where are they going with this roster as it's currently constructed? And again, you don't have to sell off all the pieces. You just need a reset. Because, like, I want to keep Bogdan around. I want to keep DeAndre Hunter around. I probably want to keep Onyeka Okongwu around, to be honest. But, like, you got to fix that backcourt. And, like, if you can move John Collins.
Well, didn't they just extend Hunter anyway? I don't think they would trade him.
No, I know. I'm just saying. Yeah, I think they have pieces that I don't want to completely tear down.
They miss Kevin Huerter. They really do. And
the Kings love him.
Yeah, we'll see what happens to this team and a lot of the other teams. I don't know how active this trade deadline is going to be. I don't know if there's going to be like star level players being dealt, but there's obviously going to be plenty of moves.
And keep saying it's quiet because
that's how the reverse jinx happens. So that's what we want. But this has been fun. Hour and a half talking hoops, midseason awards. Zach fires up the trade machine and the tier updates, which probably will be a weekly occurrence. So we like to see that. Zach, content-wise, FTN Fantasy, FTN Daily, FTN Bets. I mean, we got still a bunch of articles, streams, and all that stuff until the All-Star break. So
yeah, I mean, still going strong, obviously. Excited now. Another benefit of football being over is that guys like yourself, David Jones, Alex Blickle, Kyle Murray have more time to be on those NBA DFS streams. And write and do all that stuff. And it just strengthens the NBA product and the content that we're putting out there for the subs. Your season long trade deadlines are probably coming up fairly soon. Myself and Mike Randall still very active in those season long streets. Been having a couple discussions with some subs at FTN Fantasy about their season-long trade possibilities, which has been fun. So if anybody, needs that season-long advice, we have that as well. Setting up to be a really fun, the true second half of the season. And honestly, I'm looking forward to the All-Star break, because that, like, five-day break we get from streams and, like, the grind of slates every day and ownership and just everything that comes with being a daily, a DFS player. That's always a nice respite in the middle of the season.
Yeah, recording this on a Tuesday, so I believe it's a small slate, but then Wednesday, we got Cavs at Grizzlies.
Uh-huh.
Donovan Mitchell, though, I hope plays. He hurt his groin on Monday.
Is he doubtful? Yeah,
okay, I didn't see that
while we were recording.
That sucks. Not excited about that game anymore. Memphis should win by a lot. All right, well, there goes that. This has been the FTN NBA podcast. For Zach, I'm Adam. Please, rating, review, all that stuff on iTunes helps us out, because we are no longer a once every couple weeks podcast. Mm-hmm. We are multiple times a week. And how else are you going to see the ridiculous trades that Zach fires up on the trade
machine? I'll have some more next episode.
Exactly. Always want to make sure you are tuning in for that. So thanks for listening as always. Have a great week. We'll talk to you guys next time for the FTN NBA podcast. Peace.
Thanks for listening to the FTN NBA podcast. Be sure to follow the hosts on Twitter at APPfeiffer24 and KA Wissenberg DFS.